Hello and welcome to episode 45 of the Desi Outsiders podcast. I'm Ankita.
And I'm Meenu.
And this week, we are in conversation with writer Jayashree Mishra. Jayashree's debut novel, Ancient Promises, was a major bestseller in India, following which she's written 8 other books, one which is getting released soon. Her writing varies from autobiographical fiction and historical fiction.
Her story is one of breaking social barriers to let her passions thrive, especially as she stepped out of a rigid system to reclaim her own life. But apart from her success as a writer, we delve deep into other projects Jayashree is involved in, where she works just as hard and passionately as a social carer.
Welcome to the show, Jayashree. For the first time since we started this podcast, I'm finding it hard to put to words how excited I'm feeling right now, because I'm sure I'll reveal the secret for this as the interview progresses. But for the time being, all I'm going to say is that being able to talk to you right now is a dream come true for me.
That is so nice of you to say. Thank you. I'm very, very pleased to be here talking to both of you.
And thank you for taking the time to speak to us, Jayashree. I'm quite embarrassed that I wasn't really aware of your wonderful work as a writer and a social carer, but Ankita has been filling me in for the past month now, and I feel that I can write a book on your life.
Jayashree, I don't know if you remember, but back in, I think, 2010, you visited St. Teresa's College in Cochin to address a group of English literature students. Do you have any recollection of that?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. I've been to the college a couple of times, so this might have been the time there was the Cochin Book Fair going on.
This was when you were wearing a white sleeveless kurti, I clearly remember, because I was one of the girls sitting in the room that day when you addressed us.
Okay. Oh, how wonderful. Okay.
Yeah, and I still remember when I entered the seminar hall, I hadn't read even a single book because I was a first-year literature student. I hadn't read a single book of yours, and I wasn't sure if I was going to start reading your books because you were here to address my class. And, you know, like I said, you were in this white sleeveless kurti, and you spoke beautifully and passionately about your books, and you were also very witty because I remember someone asked you who's your biggest inspiration to write, and you said, I should probably say husband, but I'm going to say my agent is my biggest inspiration to write.
I don't remember this actually.
Yeah, I have a very strange memory. Meenu always says that it's a memory of an elephant, so I can remember things. But I remember that at the end of the session, our teachers told us that you were up for interacting with us and for answering questions, but they specifically warned us not to ask you anything about your personal life. And to me, at the time, although I hadn't even read Ancient Promises, it really seemed like you were the kind of person who wouldn't have had a problem with the questions because you'd already spoken about the autobiographical nature of your first book. Anyway, I was just lacking in confidence as I sat there having a major woman crush on you, and I never got up to ask you a question.
Ask me any questions.
Nope, I never got up. I didn't have the confidence to stand up and ask you a question. So I feel like my life has come full circle now that I'm sitting here getting ready to interview you.
I remember, actually, now it's coming back, because was that the time, it's her name, Tessie Anthony?
Yes.
Yeah, she was the person who sort of introduced me on stage, isn't it? You're the head of the English department.
Yes, she
and
was.
There were lots of very smart questions. I do remember that. So I was kind of hoping you would say you were one of those, but never mind, here's your chance. Ask away.
But I was one of the
smart ones.
No, but I was one of those girls who stood in line to get Ancient Promises signed by you. And that evening, I went back and I started reading your book. And this is something that I need to tell you. I wanted to tell you this for the past 7 years, and I'm so glad for this opportunity. Now, when I started reading Ancient Promises, I became Janu. You won't believe the similarities between Janu's story and my own, because my dad was also in the Indian Air Force. I was an only child. We visited Kerala during summer vacation. And believe it or not, this is the most interesting part. My first boyfriend, who also happened to be my boyfriend at the time when I was reading this book, his name was the same as Janu's in the story.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness me.
Yeah, that was quite a...
What's very weird is that there are a lot of people who say to me by writing Ancient Promises, I don't know whether you know, but you've told my story. And this is something I hear time and time again. I mean, you seem, yours is actually quite specific, some of the similarities, the Air Force daughter, the only child. I should hasten to say I'm not myself an only child, but in the book I kind of, this was a part of the fictionalizing of the story. I made Janu an only child to kind of keep it less complicated. But you're right, you know, what you describe of yourself is actually quite similar to the Janu in the book. But when young women and women who are a whole lot younger than I am tell me that they I've sort of told their story. I find it actually a bit alarming because I would have hoped that this book was written about, well, more than 20 years ago. I would have hoped that the world has moved on and changed. So I'm really hoping, Ankita, that you're going to say the similarity ends there and you were not sort of forced into a marriage or any of the other horrible things.
I'm happy to say that the similarity did end there. So far, good. So good.
Good.
But,
good.
You know.
But there are a lot of people who tell me that the rest of the story is theirs. And when I know they're only about, you know, in their 30s or 20s, I panic a bit because I feel we really should have moved on much more than we seem to have done. But anyway, we'll come to that. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think the best way for me to start off this interview would be by at least mentally noting the parallels between the novel and what actually happened. Because at the end of the day, like we told you, we're going to share your story of how you got to where you are right now. Okay. So can you start off by telling us about your military Air Force upbringing?
Okay, well, for an Air Force upbringing, and you'll be familiar with much of that, it was actually quite a settled sort of childhood. So we didn't move madly from place to place. Largely, we were in Delhi with about 3 or 4 years in Bangalore thrown in somewhere. There were a couple of years in England, but I was really quite young and don't remember much of it. So when someone asks me to think of my childhood, it's Delhi that springs to mind. And it's Delhi of the 60s and 70s that I think of. And that's pretty much, you know, more or less where all my school education took place and a little bit a part of college education as well. So it was a happy childhood. As I said, in real life, I'm not an only child. So I have a brother. He's 2 years older than I am. And my mother is a teacher. So a small, close-knit sort of family. You know, most of our needs were met within reason and lots of friends wherever we lived because of the Air Force. Occasionally, we would be actually living on a camp, but that was not sort of the norm. But surrounded by people my age, other children, school friends. It was a warm, sort of happy and very settled kind of childhood. Usually they do say that it takes a sort of unhappy childhood for, you know, sort of strong writing to emerge. A lot of people who've had unhappy sort of experiences very early on in life are the ones who have the raw material ready to go by the time they're in their 20s and 30s and ready to write. But yeah, I didn't have that. And all my experiences, which then later come, you know, got fed into the book, came much later, which is why I think I'm actually quite late to come to, I was quite late to come to writing. I think most people would, you know, complete their first book when they're in their 20s, say late 20s, whereas I was, well, older than that.
Well, I guess maybe now this isn't quite obvious, Jayashree, but back then, did you notice a stark difference in culture between Delhi and Kerala?
Oh, enormous, enormous. In fact, that's probably the bit that Ankita has picked up on when she says she's related to much of, you know, that part of the book, the earlier part of the book. I think anyone who's grown up outside of any Malayali who's grown up outside of Kerala and then gets taken back, and I think this is still the case. I don't think it's changed very much in the years since, you know, I was a child, but gets taken back to Kerala for the occasional summer holiday will be familiar with that huge culture divide that exists between, I don't know, a big city, Delhi, Bombay kind of girl and what you still get to see in Kerala. Now, it's not as if Kerala hasn't developed. It's still developed exceedingly well in some instances. And I know for a fact that, you know, that lots of people have started returning to do some very interesting work in places like Trivandrum and Cochin. But I think it's something to do with a very deep-seated kind of Kerala conservatism. What you essentially find in terms of attitudes, in terms of kind of mindsets, has remained, I think, pitifully similar to what it was, I don't know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. And I find that quite distressing, really. I've recently lived in Kerala again, spent 2 years there. We were building a small place on Veli Beach, which is very near Trivandrum, and spending, you know, lots of time in Trivandrum, which, capital city, you would have thought, you know, again, highly educated people, highly empowered women, financially independent, lots of working, you know, the workforce is more than 50%, I would say, female, if you look across the classes. And despite that, I find many things just hadn't changed from the 80s, which was my previous experience of living in Kerala. Many things, and I find that quite alarming.
And I myself am from Trivandrum. I spent about, I think, 7-8 years of my life in Trivandrum. And I can totally understand what you're saying right now, because unfortunately, we don't even have a mall right now. And it's a capital city, and we still don't even have a mall. I mean, that's a very minute, tiny detail, but...
There is. As it happens, there's a huge mall coming up, that Lulu Mall, which I think is he a Bahraini businessman? I'm not sure where. But he's got these enormous malls in the Middle East, and one of those huge, apparently some zillions of square feet coming up, actually quite near Beliet in a place called Arkulam. You know, I can't help wondering, being Trivandrum, how well it's going to do, how much footfall it's going to get. I mean, you might just get people who go along for the curiosity factor and, you know, want to wander around to somewhere comfortable and cool and all that. But Trivandrum remains not a great place for businesses that need you to go and spend their money to try out something new by way of food or, you know. It's just so stuck in its ways. So we shall see. I mean, it's coming up and I think it'll take at least 2 or 3 years. But you're right. There are some things that simply won't succeed in Kerala, I think.
And you're talking about something like just having a mall right now in Trivandrum. And I'm just shocked to hear that. Because I just wanted to ask you that teenage dating in schools is getting quite normalized now in India. Not that it wasn't happening before, but kids and parents are starting to feel more comfortable talking about it. And there is, you know, there is some transparency between them regarding this to an extent. It wasn't like that for my generation. It definitely wasn't like that for yours. So when you dated your first boyfriend in school, how did that go down?
Oh, like a lead balloon. Badly. It was, I mean, this was Delhi, so things should have been different, as you say. But my own family were quite conservative. We were very, my parents were very Malayali in the way they thought. They were the first generation to have left Kerala. So they both had their basic education there, you know, in Kerala, and then left my father's job, and then my mother subsequently worked and so on. So they were still very rooted in the Kerala tradition. And so for them, the idea of a daughter sort of going out and getting herself a boyfriend would have been absolute anathema. It just wasn't acceptable. Delhi itself was changing. So I had amongst my circle of very close friends who, as it happens, are still my close friends. It was quite varied. So there was one of them whose parents were completely relaxed about boys coming around to the house and parties where boys and girls mixed quite freely. Dance parties, we used to call them. Whereas there were other friends whose parents were more similar to mine. And this is a whole, it was Punjabi friends and Bengali friends and people from different parts of India who'd congregated in this big melting pot of a city. So, I would say more people were worried about daughters, sort of being, sort of going astray, if you like, with the mingling of boys. We all went to a girls' school. That's my close circle of friends. So we didn't have much exposure within the school to sort of making friends with boys. So all that happened outside of school, and that was a much more protected sphere where, you had to have mom's permission, you had to kind of meet in each other's houses. There weren't very many places to go to either where you would be safe and, in the company of people of the opposite sex. So it was all quite difficult, I would say, even back then. That's changed. And I'm pleased to say that in Delhi now it's about, it's common as anything for a young person to have a boyfriend fairly early in life. By the time they're in their mid-teens, late teens, it's kind of, I think the families have learned to accept the reality. But it's odd that Kerala still manages to hold on to that. It is simply not accepted even today. And I mentioned this place in Veli that we've built. It's a tiny little house right on the beach. And the beach is obviously a very popular hangout for college students. So we see a lot of young people, obviously, bunking class and coming out on the pillion of a motorcycle and sitting under an umbrella. Just looking out to sea, sometimes holding hands. I don't think they even go as far as that, actually, but they're just sitting there enjoying each other's company. And on at least 2 or 3 occasions, I've seen the police turn up and take them away. So, right outside my gate, I'll see a police jeep. And the first time I saw it, obviously, I was a bit alarmed because I thought they'd come for us. And I went outside to have a look at what trouble we might be in. And I saw this pair of, you know, rather bewildered and frightened looking youngsters in the back of the Jeep, who clearly had been doing nothing wrong, just sitting there and, you know, talking to each other. So I asked one of the neighbors, and he was a fisherman himself, why they'd been taken away. And he said, oh, they're up to no good when they come over here. So it's a general sort of fear that people have, that there's, these kids are going to do something, you know, start canoodling or doing something silly. And they're not. It's just, you know, they wouldn't have the guts to do anything silly anyway. That even that sitting next to each other out somewhere public like that is not on.
So I wanted to ask you, how old, or, you know, shall I say, how young were you when you entered into an arranged marriage in Kerala?
Oh, I was, in the book, Janu's 18. It's her 18th birthday, if you remember. But I was actually 19. So again, for dramatic purposes and all that, I made her 18 years old. But yeah, 19 was the age I was.
So, Jeshri, do you think that your parents finding out about your boyfriend triggered them to arrange a hasty marriage for you?
I think partially. It was partially that. They had, I think what was happening was, because of grandmothers back in Kerala, a lot of proposals had started coming. And this was because, I don't know, I'd been, sometimes it's just, you know, in family networks, people talk, they say, oh, there's a girl there. But I'd been back to Kerala and stayed with my, I'd been on a solo holiday, which at the time I didn't know was going to have so many ramifications. But I'd gone to my grandmother's house when I was about 16 or 17, I think, and spent a summer with her. And she took me all over the place, you know, showing me off, because she was quite pleased to have a grandchild coming and staying without the interference of anyone else. So I think I got spotted on some of those occasions, which of course makes me sound like some sort of raging beauty or something. But it's just that people kind of came to know that there was a girl like this growing up in Delhi. So proposals started coming. So I think there was a certain amount of pressure anyway, which might have come to bear even if the boyfriend wasn't on the scene. But yeah, I think once they found out, then it just made things a bit firmer for them in their minds, because they might have been thinking, they were surely thinking, you know, should we just allow her to study, to carry on in Delhi? She seems happy here and all of that. But there were two things that happened. One was that my father was very keen I should become a doctor, and I wasn't very keen. So I made a very half-hearted attempt at sitting the medical entrance exams.
I wasn't very keen either.
but you are a doctor.
But here I am. No, I'm in my final year now.
Goodness.
Yeah, I am.
But then you've obviously got what it takes. I don't think I would have done. So I kind of wriggled out at a very early stage, you know, the entrance exam stage, really. I said, I didn't try hard enough, didn't make it to the best medical schools in Delhi. And in those days, there weren't that many options. There was the usual All India Institute and AFMC and Vellore, and that was it. So when I didn't make it, and I knew what it was that I wanted to do, which was English literature, I just knew I liked books and I liked, I didn't know about writing, but I knew I liked language a lot. So that, you know, I kind of wriggled my way out of that and decided to do a course, to do a BA in English literature instead. But that was a disappointment, I think, certainly to my father, but I'd say to both my parents to some extent. And so the kind of interest that they had in getting me sort of in my further education started to wane around that point. So it was a combination of different things, really. It was, but the boyfriend had a part to play, yes. Boyfriend who's now my husband sitting in that room and watching television.
So, Jeshri, we have discussed the concept of love and arranged marriages in Desi Homes on this podcast a fair bit, but we mostly talk about it with relevance to the present generation. Yeah. But you're from that generation in India where an arranged marriage was the norm. It isn't so much now, and especially in close-knit societies back then, like those in Kerala, as you've spoken about. But since you had quite a bit of exposure growing up, did you ever question your family's choice of groom, or even the decision to get you married at such a young age? Because I'm pretty sure that at such a tender age, and with the family that you were in, it must have been quite scary to even confront them or even question their decisions for you.
I think and I hope that young people have sort of stronger voices within their families, at least these days. I mean, looking around me at, you know, nieces and friends' children, I get the impression that they're all pretty genuinely empowered to be able to voice their opinions. I didn't feel that way, and I don't think I was an exception, because I think many of my friends were similar. So if our parents, and I think it is a generational thing, if our parents said, this is what you're going to do, we pretty much accepted that that was what we were going to do. And did I question it? Yes and no is the answer. I think I did, because I didn't like it. I certainly didn't want to leave Delhi. I didn't want to live in Kerala particularly. I didn't want to leave my friends. When I was enjoying college, I'd done my first year of college. So I was enjoying that quite a lot. So for all those reasons, rather than being anti-arranged marriage, I think it was just the fact that I didn't want to be far away from the familiar and from my friends. So I certainly didn't like it. I did voice an opinion, but when there was pressure to bear, and I think the one element that probably still carries on even with younger people, you know, with today's generation of young women, is that we are very, and this is a female thing, I think, but we are very, somehow very convinced by the idea of the parental happiness or family, the familial kind of happiness resting on our shoulders. We take that very seriously.
Oh, yes.
We are very sensitive to it. It's actually quite a self-centered and rather arrogant view in a strange sort of way. And it's difficult to explain why I think it's arrogant, but I think it's the arrogance of someone very young and very unthinking to imagine that what they say and do is actually everybody else's happiness depends on that. But we do, and I think girls are particularly prone to this, is that we genuinely think that we hold it in our hands to make the family either very happy or very unhappy. And most of us, most women, you know, they're sort of keen to do the right thing and very keen not to make their families unhappy. It's, I think, more common than not to sort of go against the grain of what your every instinct is telling you and do something for the sake of everybody else. And on the one hand, it's a very generous act, but on the other hand, it's also very silly to imagine that that is the case. Because I've, from having witnessed what happens what's happened in many other people's lives, is if they take a stand and they're very sure of themselves to be able to take that stand, they might make everybody around them, the family, unhappy for a while, but it doesn't last. You know, that's the tragedy of it. When girls think, oh, well, they're going to be unhappy forever if I do this. It's that kind of arrogance or stupidity that does them such a disfavor. Because in the end, if you're very sure of yourself, you have the courage of your own convictions, and you take a stand which is one of calm sort of knowledge, other people just do fall in line. So it's really worth taking that sort of a position, because very gradually, maybe it'll take time, maybe it'll take months rather than weeks, but they do.
I think you made a very good point about this idea that we feel that we are responsible for someone's happiness, whether it's your mom, your dad, or your family. But with the same token, I do believe that a lot of families sort of drill it into our heads from a very young age, and they sort of groom us throughout our childhood and possibly some of our adulthood to make us believe that we are responsible.
Especially daughters.
Absolutely. And I think, I mean, imagining that everybody's happiness or the family's happiness rests in your hands is just a few steps less bad than imagining the family honor rests on your shoulders. And, you know, once you start getting into that business of honor and how it becomes your responsibility, it's that curious mix of selfishness and arrogance and silliness, and it's you know, you if one should make oneself less important than that and sort of feel quite strong about the fact that, you know, the family's honor will continue regardless of what it is that you might do. I think, I mean, I'm saying this as someone who would like to see things change, who would like to see things change faster than they're changing. But I should hold myself back, because I am aware of the fact that in a lot of families, and the word honor is a very sort of loaded one, because we hear about honor killings and, you know, they're still happening, and maybe not in the very urban sort of setup as much as, you know, outside of that. But even in the UK, you hear of honor killings. And it's just, you know, that the idea that you're right. I think we are groomed. Women are, girls are by and large brought up to believe these notions. It's still around. We can't get away from that just yet.
And I perfectly understand what you're describing, you know, because I'm from Kerala myself, and I understand what it was like 20, 30 years ago, both from my own experience as well as from the things that I've heard women from my mom's generation share. So, you got married, not too many questions were asked, not many answers were given, and you probably just settled into a new routine and a new life with this new family of yours. So, Jayashree, terms like adjustment and compromise, they used to be thrown around a lot even while I was growing up. The other day, I was just saying that I wrote a blog post about my husband and I cleaning the bathroom together, and then my mom called me up and she said that I should probably not make him clean the bathroom with me. And I was like, why? Doesn't he use the same bathroom too? What are you talking about? And let's just say that my mother was not too pleased with what I said. So I think it wouldn't be too wrong to assume that at the age of 19, if you had any initial teething trouble settling into this new life with your new family, you were probably just expected to adjust and get on with it.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Adjust. That was such a big, important word. And even when things went wrong, when things started going sort of quite badly wrong, there was still the thing I was sort of told on a number of occasions was, it's not as bad as it could have been, or not as bad as so-and-so who actually gets beaten up. Extreme examples would be given to me. And I would be told, come on, it's not as bad as that. Therefore, just adjust. And that word is a cruel word, really, used to a young person who, you know, has already set aside their own dreams and hopes and plans and whatnot.
And again, this is another word that is told from a young age again, you know, that you have to adjust in your life. And as girls, especially when grandmothers and neighbors are looking for prospective husbands, they use this word so much, and they even use it in Bollywood films, and you hear it everywhere. So when it comes to your turn, I'm pretty sure you were just like, yeah, well, I guess I just have to do it because everyone does it.
Everyone does it.
Yeah.
The concept, I think those the sort of being able to get away from those ideas, hopefully they're getting better now. I mean, would a young person who finds herself in some sort of pickle still feel the pressure to adjust? Well, actually, I don't know. I think they probably still do.
It all depends, really, doesn't it, on which part of the world we're talking about, which kind of community
world you are, and what sort of family you're in, and what sort of family you've come from. But yeah, it's quite amusing what your mum said about the toilet cleaning. Because, yeah, we seem to have, you know, women are their own worst enemies. So, you know, the messages we get from our own mums are, you know, about the least feminist messages that you would get, it's not so much men telling you, giving you these messages as much as other women. And that's the tragedy of it, isn't it?
Yeah. And you were just 22 when your child was born, which I believe was an anomaly back then, because even Ankita has told me about some of her classmates who are from our generation, and they were married and had kids by the age of 19, 20 while they were studying. So going back to your college education, Jayashree, what made you decide to pursue a degree while still caring for your young daughter, and that too a child with special needs?
The degree was when I completed my degree before having her. So she was born soon after I'd finished my BA. But the bit which I did after she was born, in fact, by then she was about five or so, was my MA. So that was the part that was really difficult. Because she was not really born and around, but she, by then, her special needs were starting to exhibit themselves and create problems because, you know, there was sort of behavioral issues and so on. So that was one hell of a struggle. But the reason why I did that was by then I knew that I needed to escape. By then I had my little escape plan in mind, and the MA was a very important part of it because I was going to go off to study abroad. I was the plan I had was to do a course in special education. I'd been doing a little bit of voluntary work at my daughter's school, special school in Cochin, so I sort of knew what to sort of say in an application form. And I started to apply. But wherever I applied, and this was different universities to do a diploma in special education, I was being told you need to have, if you're coming from India, you need to have a postgrad at least. So they were not accepting the fact that I had a BA. They wanted to see more than that in order to give me admission to what eventually turned out to be a postgrad diploma. So I knew I had to do the MA. The funny thing is that once I started the MA, despite the difficulties, partially because of where I did it and the tutor under whom I was doing it and the group, there were about 20 women who were doing it as private candidates alongside me. It sort of worked out very, very well. They were a very supportive bunch. I had the loveliest of professors. I don't know whether the name Professor Madhukar Rao means anything to you, Ankita. You might not have heard of him because he's...
I have, in fact. One of my teachers used to talk about him all the time.
All the time. Because, yeah, he would be more familiar to the teachers in your... than your own generation, because he would have taught a lot of them. But basically just going to his home, because he used to conduct his classes on the rooftop of his house, going to his home day after day and meeting his wife and his daughter-in-law, who also helped him, and professor himself, and being with this bunch of rather mad classmates was such a release from the world I'd found myself trapped in till then. So before too long, I was really enjoying IMA. So after a while, it wasn't a struggle. It was my escape. It was my sanity. It was what I really, really needed. What kept me sane and what kept me alive, I think, in those years. It was really tough otherwise.
And when you decided to pursue this degree, were people around you supportive of this decision?
No, in short. Anyone. Not my in-laws at the time, and not even my own family, really. It's very much like Ankita's mom saying, husband, cleaning the bathroom. It was very much MA. Why do you want to do an MA? They're well off. They have this very successful business. You're never going to be short of money. What do you need to sort of study? You're not going to go and work. It was all this kind of talk around. It was, of course, much worse from the family I was married into, because they were the ones who were right there. So I was hearing their comments a lot more. But I didn't sense a huge amount of encouragement from my parents either. But I think, and this is to be trying to be fair, you know, and sort of trying to remember things in a fair and objective way, I think by then my mother, actually my father had passed away by then. So it was just my mum and grandmum. And they had picked up quite a strong sense of my unhappiness. I hadn't actually divulged very much at that point, but they knew enough to know that I was quite unhappy. So when they saw that the MA had perked me up and that, you know, I seemed altogether happier and I was probably being a better mother as well to my daughter, they rallied around and they did, you know, it was finally there, my grandmother's house, where I went and stayed and did the final few weeks of preparation and did my viva and all of that from there, from Alipi, her house. So it got a bit more encouraging as I went along, but not, certainly not from the family I was married into at the time, because there was a big wedding coming up, a big family wedding. And I was needed to do the more important stuff, which was, you know, sort of being around when relatives came and helping out with the preparations, the sweet making and all that sort of stuff. But by then, something had kicked in for me. And I think I just knew that it wasn't, even though I was still, my every instinct, which still is the case, actually, this is the word grooming that you use absolutely correctly, Meenal.
But, oh, thank you, Jeshri. I'm going to remember this for a long time now.
I was so groomed into the idea of doing what other people wanted of me. I was still fighting my every instinct. But the thing is, I knew I had to finish my MA. I just knew it by then. And I knew that that was the only way I was going to be able to get out. Because I had, I think, a couple of offers, tentative offers from universities, both in the US and in the UK. But they'd all said the same thing, do an MA first. So, it by then become so important, I managed to fight off that instinct to, oh, they need me now, it's the wedding, and, you know, I better be there for them, and all that kind of nonsense.
And anyone who's read your first book, Ancient Promises, or even Googled your name, is surely aware of the work that you've done towards helping children with special needs and how this desire to work extensively, like you said, for your postgraduate diploma as well, it stemmed from your own personal experiences. Your daughter herself is a child with special needs. And in your book, you've even given quite a graphic and emotional description of the events that led to this discovery. But just to put things into perspective for our listeners, back in the 1980s, in Kerala, what was the attitude towards children with special needs like?
It hasn't changed much. I mean, people one-on-one are kind enough. So, no one's going to say anything within the kind of circles you move, say anything really nasty or hurtful, I don't suppose. But I don't know quite how to describe it. there's still a kind of sense that, and this is just because I've got England to compare it against, that you are to be pitied. It's something to be pushed aside, if possible, not mentioned unless absolutely necessary. That still persists. So, you know, I mean, if I'm with my daughter and I meet, and, you know, we're meeting up with people and, I don't know, family, friends or whatever, obviously everyone's going to be nice to her and, you know, and to me and so on. But no one ever says things like, could you possibly not bring her along? Or nothing like that. You know, I wouldn't even contemplate anyone saying that. But there is, I think you can sense the sympathy kind of exuding, and I'd rather not have too much of that. So, she just is my norm. So, you know, it's, and I find that I can't help then comparing, especially when I'm there and I'm facing something to that, something like that. I can't help thinking, oh goodness, things are so much better in England for people like her, where there's a lot more acceptance. Not uniformly so. I mean, there are problems. There can be problems here as well. And, you know, you hear stories occasionally where, you know, in a restaurant or something, a group of people with special needs have been taken out, and the people at the next table say, can you move us, please, and so on. So it happens. But stories like that would actually get noticed and then go in the papers, and then somebody's obviously objecting to it. Whereas there is still very much the norm, that kind of, you know, can you keep people out of the way, please?
Yeah, Jeshri, it's really interesting because just a couple of months back, I did my rotation in pediatrics. And when the child is born, we do a lot of tests, not just to check their motor function and sensory function, but also their intellectual and cognitive functions. And it's done in a very rigorous way. Now, considering that Czech Republic just came out of communism around 20 years ago, to see this progress in the medical field was quite, you know, it was quite shocking to me, because I've worked in some hospitals in India and I've seen kids come in and doctors just don't care and the community doesn't care for them. So to see this in Czech Republic was very heartwarming for me. I was very happy to see that. Now, I can't imagine what it was like in the 1980s, because I say that, you know, now when a child is born, we go through all these tests, but did your daughter have all these tests done?
Not immediately, because nothing was apparent right at the start. But somewhere along the way, and I think at about 8 or 9 months, I started to think that there was, you know, her milestones were all getting delayed and so on. So with an enormous amount of pressure from me, certain sets of tests were done. So there was some genetic testing done, and nothing that revealed very much. And I went to Bangalore and went to, it's not NIMHANS, but there's the other institute there for what's called something, National Institute for Mental, I think it's probably called MR, mental retardation or something like that. And I went to that institute, and there were a whole set of tests and studies done on her then. But it was all at my instigation. There wasn't any automatic sort of system into which you got pulled in once it was found that your child had special needs. So no, and I really don't know what that is like in India today. When a special needs kid is born, whether there's a sort of slightly better level of support and investigation.
Well, my one of my mom's cousins, she has a child who's about 4 years old now, and she doesn't respond very well to she communicates a few things, but she doesn't respond to her own name sometimes. And obviously any parent would be worried about that, especially at the age of four. And they're in Fatehabad in North India, and they travel to Delhi every month to see a doctor. But the doctor is giving no information to them. He just keeps telling them, like, make sure that she draws a lot, make sure she's outside playing, which I think anybody can just Google. Like, it's not very good information to give as a doctor. So I think that, you know, especially from what I've seen from my mom's cousin, unfortunately, I don't see that the doctors do so much in terms of helping for the child. And I think that it's really important that doctors, at least in Czech Republic, from what I've seen, they put the child first. Even if they have to stay until 5 hours after their shift, they'll put the child first. But I haven't seen that much in India, unfortunately.
No.
But maybe, I mean, I'm speaking from what I've seen. I don't know what it's like in other parts.
Well, see, in India, there's the added layer of private medical care with all its vested interests. And that would worry me, because, you know, I would think, I mean, if a doctor is just routinely seeing this child every month and not actually making much of a difference, not suggesting anything, then clearly he's just quite happy to sit there and collect his consultancy fees. Mm. So, I would be very, very worried, actually, even today, on behalf of children with special needs born in India.
We promised to go back to your life and your story first, Jeshri. But first, can you just tell us a little bit about the residential home for intellectually challenged adults that you've set up in Delhi over the past few years?
That was actually, you know, it didn't start off as a massively altruistic sort of project, because it started off very early on, I'd say about 20 years ago, soon after Ancient Promises was written. And, you know, I moved back to India in the year 2000, so 17 years ago. Because the idea was to try and live in India at that point in time, we needed somewhere that, you know, our daughter could go to that would be, she was then about 14 or 13 or thereabouts, I think. So, we got talking. Someone put us in touch with a set of parents. I mean, actually one parent of someone with special needs who was about the same age as Rohini, my daughter. And through that person, we met a whole bunch of parents. So we were a group of about seven sets of parents with our seven kids with special needs, all different sorts of needs. And we started talking to each other, meeting up regularly. It was once a month we used to meet in somebody's house. And to try and think of something that we could create for the sake of our own children, some kind of long-term residential place. And that, the group kind of met a few times, and about 2 years down the line, because it involved each of us actually putting quite a lot of money down, renting or buying a place in Delhi, not being, you know, easy. A few people fell by the wayside, and around that time I moved back to England, and so it kind of fell apart. But what happened was that within a sort of subgroup for about two or three of us stayed in touch with each other. And one member of that group started to lobby the government, because she was already running a special school. So she started lobbying the government to try and get land or a building off them in order to set up this residential unit. And it took her, I don't know how long, her name's Shanti Olak, and she's the school she runs is called Muskan. It's quite well known in Delhi. But she just lobbied and lobbied and lobbied and didn't give up, and managed to get a large, what's called a disused Padat Ghar. I don't know if the word means anything to you, but it's, you know, it's one of those, it was built originally to be a community center or a place where wedding parats, you know, weddings would take place for people who couldn't afford hotels. And this one was just lying disused somewhere, and the Delhi government decided to use it, put it to some good use. And she managed to get hold of that. And once she got hold of that, she hastily put a committee together in order to sort of get the project off the ground and make it. So I was on her committee because I had stayed in touch with her through the years. And so I joined her, and again, we were a group of about 10 of us who were on the committee. We got this place up and running. So it's there. It's in a place called Dera Mandi on the outskirts of Delhi. It's in a place called, it's just beyond Chhatarpur. And it's huge. I mean, the building is massive and it sits on 3 acres of land. So we were really, really quite lucky to get this thanks to Shanti's hard work. And it took in, while I was still there in India, we sort of interviewed a few people and got the staff, sort of the skeletal staff going, got the place kind of as ready as we could, given the, you know, the limited funds we had. And there are, you know, at the time there were about seven people who started living there under that one roof. But there are plans to have little cottages on the 3 acres that surround the place to make it less of an institution and more of a sort of like little family homes. And each house should obviously have its own foster mum, and things like that haven't happened yet. I left Delhi as well around that time, moved down to Kerala for a while, and then now I'm back here in England. But it's, the numbers have increased, so they've now got, I believe it's about 20 odd people, but they're still, what they've done is create more rooms inside the big what was the community center, the mother unit. And that's not ideal, because I've seen it with seven or eight people in it, and really we were sort of reaching a reasonable limit at that point. So yeah, I think it's probably flailing slightly at the moment. It's struggling. But unless it gets a huge injection of funds, I don't think they're going to be able to take it to that next stage.
So what can anyone who's listening to this podcast and wants to help out do to help the cause?
Oh, difficult, because we're looking, you know, it's large sums of money that would be required. I mean, if one is to build about, say, 10, I would say there's room for about 10 cottages to sit quite comfortably on the premises. So to build 10 cottages and then, you know, sort of get it. Staffing is not such an expense in India, because you can still hire people relatively cheaply. But it's about training them and making sure you get the right kind of people and then train them up to have the right kind of attitude. So all that takes, you know, time and money. But the most important part really is the building of the place itself. Because once you've got that, then you can start thinking in terms of increasing the number of people. But if anyone's genuinely interested in helping, that they should contact someone called Shanti Olak or me, and I can always put them in touch with the right people. But she's the one who's on the ground there right now. So, and it's, I think much of the details are available on Muskaan's website as well. So it's Muskaan Delhi.
Okay, thank you for that, Jayashree. And you have a diploma in special education, and not to mention your years of experience in the field, both as a parent as well as a social worker. So what would you say from your experiences is the best form of support we can offer to children with special needs, whether with the parent, the family members, teachers, or even just family friends?
I would say if you're a friend or a relative of someone who has a child with special needs, just try and give them a break whenever you can, because that's the thing I look back to with the most sort of regret, is that, you know, there would have been many times when I would have got so fed up with my daughter and with having to sort of constantly, I still do, you know, constantly listen to the sort of repetitive talk and this repetitive behavior and all of that is, you know, just to, that I would have been a much nicer parent and more patient had someone just come along and said, look, you really need a break. Just take the afternoon off, go off, do a bit of shopping, go and, you know, see a film, or even if you just go somewhere and read a book, you know, give yourself a little time and space. I would come back 10 times a better mom to my daughter. And yeah, I think I just didn't get enough of that when I was bringing her up. So yeah, if it's possible at all to, in England, there were schemes, there were sort of, what are they called? Respite care schemes that almost as soon as we arrived and she started going to school became available to her. So there would be families who would, you know, they were available on a register and you could call up and, you were allowed, the social services department paid for a certain amount of it. And if you wanted more, then you could pay and get it for yourself. But there were families who were trained to take in a child with special needs and keep them as a part of their own family. So they were screened and police checked and all of that before, obviously, you know, social services would allow a special needs child to go to their homes. But something like that, just offer a little. In India, the idea of setting up a whole organization like that was just too alarming. So, but if you know someone, they're on your personal kind of radar, just offer. They might not take up the offer. They might be too nervous. They might be, you know, they might not want to burden a friend with too much. But just the offer of that kind of help could be a lifesaver.
And was it a lack of this kind of a support system that kind of forced you to decide to leave your marriage and the whole environment that wasn't being very kind to both Rohini and yourself?
It certainly played a huge part. And it had, I mean, actually my husband now, was the boyfriend I had back then and as a teenager, he often laughs. I mean, it's a sort of joke between us, but it's a semi-serious joke. And he says, had Rohini been normal, he says, you probably never would have left. And I've sort of thought about that quite a bit, because, I mean, in my private moments, I sort of try and think of an alternative sort of world where, you know, had Rohini not had her special needs. I use the word normal for want of another word, but, you know, she is my normal, but for want of another word. Had she not had all of this, and had she just been growing up alongside her cousins in Kerala, there's every chance, yeah, I wouldn't have run away, and I wouldn't have done, you know, taken this very brave step, because I would have been thinking partially of her. I would have been thinking, goodness, you know, a woman who runs away and tries out a new life somewhere far away.
Again, it's a mother-daughter thing, right? I wouldn't want to put my daughter in a position. Yeah. If you had a son, obviously you would have the same concerns, but it wouldn't be quite the same, because daughter changes everything.
Yeah, again, you're marking your child from a very early age, and then, you know, what would her future be like with that little mark? So you think of all these things, these reasons to not do it. Whereas because she had special needs, actually, that became my passport out of there. It became my reason for being able to leave, and, you know, it became my motivation. It became doubly important for me to be able to do it, not just for myself, but also for her, because I knew she would have a better deal altogether if we moved abroad. It was going to be America at first, and then I met, you know, my husband now, and so it became England. But I just knew that it was going to be a better life for her, and touching wood, it really has been. You know, I could never have dreamt of the kind of things she gets here so normally, you know, so much as a matter of course. She would never have been able to get, unfortunately, in India. So,
and by 1990, you know, you were well into the process of getting a divorce and fending for yourself. But Jayashree, I've personally heard from girls, even from my generation today, who were told that a divorce would bring disgrace to the family, that if you leave your husband and you come home, then we won't open the gates to your childhood home. And basically, everyone just still stigmatizes divorce and expects you to just resolve the issues. And like I said earlier, get on with it. So if the stigma is so bad, even today, what was it like in 1990 when you took the step?
Oh, this, I think it, you know, I think I vented all of that by writing Ancient Promises. So there's a scene in there in which I liken Kerala to an old man sitting on his haunches and, you know, sitting back with laughter and slapping his knees and sort of thinking. So yeah, it's a cruel world it certainly was then to took a step like that. And I couldn't go anywhere. And the funny thing is, even today, when I'm at some big society wedding or something in Kerala, and I was at one quite recently, let's say about 4 or 5 months ago, I was wondering, I spotted a cousin or somebody and I thought, oh, let me just cut across the crowd and sort of go and say hello to her. And so I was walking through a crowd and there were people, you know, sitting around. Trivandrum's is still a small town in many ways, certainly in its attitude. And I noticed out of the corner of my eye, a couple of women were sort of observing me, watching me walk. And one of them had spotted me first. She nudged the other one and bent her head across and said something. It might have been something perfectly innocent. It might have been, oh, look at the sari she's wearing, or look at that silly sort of thing she's done with her hair, or whatever. But there was something just faintly bitchy about the whole act of nudging and whispering that made me think, oh, they know I'm the one who, you know, who got divorced from that family and ran away and, you know, just all of that.
They remember. Yeah, that happened to me when my sari blouse was cut a bit too low. You know, low, I'm saying this in air quotes because some people think, it depends, right? So it's, people were nudging each other and whispering when they looked at my sari blouse as well. It's no biggie. We're so used to it by now.
But it, you know, it can dog you. It'll really sort of follow you around if you've got a reputation as someone who sort of initiated a divorce and went off.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, it's still there.
Being a single mom is hard, Jayashree. Even when you have a steady stream of income coming in, you weren't working at the time when you decided to leave your husband, were you?
I was not. No, I was just still studying. When I left, technically, I was a student. I came to University of London and did my course. So I had a very small scholarship. I really wouldn't call it an income because it was, you know, it would have been just enough for me to manage with my daughter and, you know, my whatever college expenses and so on. But I had I wouldn't describe myself as financially independent. And honestly, without the support of the man I'm married to today, it would have been tough. And this, it's a difficult thing to say for a feminist, is that I could only take that step when I had the support of somebody else. So I think of the hundreds and hundreds of people, you know, when I wrote Ancient Promises, I had an alternative ending, a bit like you have, you know, with the film, when you watch it on DVD, they show you the ending that you could have had or which the filmmaker was obviously toying with. So I had another chapter written out for the end of Ancient Promises in which Janu doesn't come back to the man, you know, who's waiting for her in England. So
that would have been heartbreaking for me as a 19-year-old reading it.
Well, you know what it was? It wasn't the romantic ending which Ancient Promises now has. It was a trying to be feminist ending, which is Janu's in the auto rickshaw and she and her mother and daughter are sitting in there. They've just come out of the courts and they're heading off. So actually, Ancient Promises ends there. It doesn't actually show her returning to England, but it's kind of unspoken and unsaid, but the reader will naturally make that assumption that she does indeed come back to England because she's got a man waiting for her. But the feminist within me was saying, I don't want to make it that sort of convenient, that chocolate boxy, because a lot of women don't get the romantic ending in their lives or the romantic solution or the romantic kind of escape clause. They just don't get it. So you know, what, where would this book be for them? Be, you know, I don't want a woman to read it and think, oh, all very well for her. She had something to bail her out. But what about me? So I tried to get that point across that Janu could have. She could have gone on and done something and worked and, you know, made a life for herself, however tough it would have been in the early years.
I just want to go back to a point you made. You know, you were saying that you spoke about how you're too afraid to speak about how your husband was maybe the driving force to get you back on your feet again. And as a feminist, you're too afraid to say that. But I just want to say that as a feminist, I think it's important we do acknowledge these influences in our life. And you shouldn't be afraid to say that.
I think you're right that as feminists, we should appreciate the feminist men that many of us have been blessed with. So, you know, so those who kind of support us to be our own, you know, and that's great. I think it's very important just to remember that and say that and acknowledge it.
But, yeah.
I sometimes, you know, I do worry that in saying too much about the men who have supported us to be feminists, it sort of rules out a lot of people who might not have that. I mean, I think there might be budding feminists who think, well, I don't have that support, so I can't be that. I can't sort of take that step. So that's why I try not to make too much of it.
Yeah. Well, the 3-year long divorce process aside, Jayashree, this is when everything in your life started to fall into place. You were with the love of your life. You had your child with you. You were in a new place, studying, working towards things you were passionate about. But to bring back the word adjustment once again, I'm sure it must have been a process for everybody involved. You know, you always say that sometimes step-parents and step-children aren't given due credit when it comes to the adjustment they go through to be accepting of a new person in their lives. And how would you describe this process that you've seen in your own life?
It was, I would say, up and down in the beginning, because it is one hell of an adjustment to make. It has suddenly become, you know, for my husband, from single solvent man to suddenly have, you know, not just a wife, which is sort of still falls within the realm of normal, is to have a wife who comes with this thing attached, this child attached to her, and then doubly complicated by the fact that she's a child with special needs. My goodness, it was quite an explosive mix. He's been terrific. I mean, men like him, I hate to think, are they rare? Because, you know, I would want to imagine that there are many others like him. But that's the way he took to parenthood more than anything else, the way he took to parenthood and special parenting, which still astounds me, because he's still more sensible with her than I am. I tend to crumble very fast and sort of feel terribly worried and emotional and anxious and all of that, which he just, and I think it's a part of being a step parent. He can step back from that and take a more sensible sort of decision or sensible point of view and feel less guilty about things than I do and all of that. So he's a very good sounding board to have around. But I don't think I should look back and forget the kind of the difficult moments, and there were enough, you know, where I would be feeling guilty. I don't anymore. Say we're having a tough time because Rohini is in a bad mood or something like that, and the day has really not been much fun for anyone. There was that phase in my life when I would have felt terribly guilty on his behalf, and I would have thought, oh, it's all because, you know, of me and my daughter and all of that. I've grown beyond that point now. So now it's, well, if he doesn't like it, he'll absent himself. He'll do whatever he can. So we've all grown used to, I hope I'm still grateful in another way, you know, in an unspoken way. I am very grateful, because I'm grateful for anyone who's kind of kind and nice.
And is it safe to say that after this adjustment period that you just talked about, that is when things took off for you career-wise?
I made myself as financially independent as I could, as I could, as soon as I could. So, you know, I started to work within a few months of us getting married and me coming to the UK with permission to work and all that. When you say career, I don't know whether you mean the writing career or the other jobs that I've done, because I've had some interesting enough jobs. First, I worked in social services, did child protection work. That was my first job in the UK. And then working with people with special needs in a college of further education. I did that for a while. And then I worked as a journalist, a broadcast journalist. I retrained. I did a course in broadcast journalism because I needed to get away from special needs at a certain stage in my life. So I did the BBC journalism bit for a little while, and then got this really interesting job as a film examiner at the Board of Film Classification. So I did that for quite a long time. And that was about the most interesting job that I've ever done, and well, you know, well paid enough for me to declare myself properly financially independent and all that.
But what propelled you towards sitting down and writing your first book, Jayashree? Did you always write?
I always enjoyed words and what I call making nice sentences. It's always, you know, a sort of fun activity for me. But I think it was pure catharsis. And it was when I had trained as a broadcast journalist and gotten this quite a nice job at the BBC as, you know, the it was a proper job. It was very difficult even in those days to get a what was not a locum, you know, proper job and all of that. But within about a month, my mother came to help out because my daughter was still quite young and she was at home and going to school and needed to be gotten ready and off in the morning. But I was on the breakfast shift, which meant leaving the house at 5 o'clock. So there's no way I could have done it without help like my mum's. You know, even my husband couldn't have helped because he couldn't have helped with getting Rohini ready, you know, the physical side of this. By then, she must have been in her early teens, sort of getting there, so she, you know, there's certain things he wouldn't have been able to help with. So as long as my mother stayed, I was fine. But when she had to go back to India when her visa ran out, I just chucked in the job. I had no option but to give the job up. And I was sitting at home feeling very sorry for myself because I was the only one on my course who'd got this BBC job. I had this new desktop lying around and I started to play around with it. And that was when I think it was an element of catharsis, but I started to write a body of text, and that body of text was what eventually became the first or the second chapter of the book, The Marriage Scene. So I was writing a little memoir because my husband was going to come back in the evening and show me how to cut and paste and do all the word functions that I didn't know about. So he said, just write something, a little piece of text, and then I'll show you what to do with it. And that, I just couldn't stop. Honestly couldn't stop writing. So, on the very first day, I think I had something like 20 pages, and then I couldn't wait for everyone to leave the house. It became 45 pages the next day and so on. So the book grew very fast because once the floodgates had opened, and this was about, you know, a number of years had passed since I had actually lived those experiences, I think they were just so well formed in my mind. There must have been little scenes and pictures that were ready, you know, to be just needed to be described and written down. So, and that was what became Ancient Promises.
And you've kind of had scattered roots, one could argue. You know, you spent time in Delhi, Kerala, and the UK pretty much in equal measure. And each of these places have appeared in your literary works as well. And a lot of writers that I have read, they like to romanticize this kind of a diasporic existence. And they often claim that they don't belong anywhere and it's too sad for them. So what is your personal take on that? Because I haven't noticed that in your writing. You mostly look like a person who belongs everywhere.
I do feel as if, I think I would echo that thing of not really belonging anywhere. But I don't think I see it, I don't romanticize it. I don't see it either as a terrible thing, nor do I see it as something which is if anything, it's slightly advantageous to be like that, because you can slip in and out of different worlds and different people's heads and, you know, all the things you need to do to be a novelist. So it's probably been quite helpful. I certainly don't mind the fact that I don't belong completely anywhere. I think I'd rather put it the way you just did, which is that I belong a little bit in all these places. So, yeah, I can be quite English when I'm in England, and I can be very Malayali when I'm in Kerala, and I can be quite Dilliwali when I'm in Delhi.
And you've written 7 books so far, Jayashree, and I'm going to ask you quite a difficult question, but can you pick your favorite book?
Actually, I've written 8 novels, and the book which is going to come out now, very shortly, actually in a couple of months' time, is my first non-fiction book. So I don't know whether I can call it number 9, because it won't be a novel. Whether it's my first non-fiction book or just my 9th book, I don't know. But of the one that will be coming out now, Ankita, you should look out for, because it's about the 2 years I spent in Kerala, and it exposes Kerala, Kerala in its present day.
I would love to read that as well, because Ankita just goes on and on about it, and I need to pick that book up too.
Do you know what I've tried to do? I don't know whether you're familiar with Bill Bryson, who's this American chap who lives in England. He's married to an English woman, and he writes books both about America and about England that are like affectionate rants. He just rants and rants because he finds lots of things that are wrong with these places, both places. But they're very, he's very funny. I don't think I'm capable of being as funny as Bill Bryson is, but I try to be affectionate. to Kerala. I've tried mm-hmm. not to make it a tirade. So it gives you a lot of information about Kerala, but it's also, much of it is negative. And it is a bit of a rant on occasion.
But do you still have a favorite?
My favorite. It's tempting to say Ancient Promises because it's been the most successful. So it's the book which people have written PhDs on, which is now, I think, prescribed in the Kerala. I'm not sure. I think it was on the Kerala University syllabus for some time. I don't know whether it still is. It's the one that people keep writing to me about, even 20 years down the line. It's never been out of print. It gets me fantastic royalties. So in a funny way, that should be my favorite book. But, I think if a mother had 8 children and one of them was very successful, she'd probably not give that child as much attention as she gives the others because she worries more on behalf of the others. I feel Ancient Promises can look after itself now. Mm. But the one that I worked hardest over was Rani, my historical fiction about Rani of Jhansi. And the fact that it got banned in UP and all that made me feel very protective about it. I'm very proud of it. It's so different as well from all the other books that I've written. But the one that I really, really enjoyed writing, and I think it's probably the only book that I can say with total honesty and that I totally enjoyed writing, was first of my secrets books. It's called Secrets and Lies. And that's the one about the Delhi schoolgirls. And I think it's because there was, again, huge amounts of me in it, but the happier elements of me, the one that we talked about very early on in this interview, the girl who was growing up, the schoolgirl growing up in Delhi and who was actually having a whale of a time. So it makes it sound like a very happy book. It's not actually. It's about a dark secret from the school days of these four girls who are now friendly. But there's a little bit of London in it. There's a bit of Delhi and Bombay. And so, again, elements of me are in the book. And yet it's not about me and it's not. So I had total abandon writing it, unlike Ancient Promises, where there was very clearly me in it. So I really do. I think, if I had to pick a favorite, it would be the one that I enjoyed writing.
So Jayashree, you'll find this really interesting, but I based my BA final year project on Rani.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, and this is why I hope everyone listening can see how important this interview is to me.
And what was the project about?
Oh, it was called a rereading of Jayashree Mishra's Rani, A Woman Who Lived Ahead of Her Times. And I basically just went through the whole book, highlighting all the instances from history where Rani Lakshmibai proved to be a woman with modern sensibilities, although she was born into a time where she was expected to sit behind a parda while she was talking to British officials. So she was just this girl who trained along with Nana Sahib and Tantia Topi, and she was this girl who liked climbing a mango tree. She was a girl who liked politics and administration and took the lead when her husband took a back seat, and how she was more peaceful and she didn't want to go into war till she was forced into it. So all these elements.
Very good reader, I must say. I should be very grateful to readers like you, because you kind of describe it almost better than I could. I write a book and then I never reread. I kind of put it away and it's gone. And it's only if a journalist or someone asks me something that I try and dredge up my memory of it. So thank you for that.
It's really special to me because Rani was the book that I picked up the minute I was done with Ancient Promises, because you also happened to speak about it at the very same seminar I spoke about. But you mentioned at that seminar that Rani was going to be turned into a movie with Sushmita Sen, but I suppose things didn't really go as planned?
No, well, I don't know. Poor thing. I actually feel very sorry for her because she was utterly decent about the whole thing. She flew me down to Bombay. She had a proper contract written up and she paid me actually very well going by normal Bombay standards, using her own money. And the reason she did all that was that she had a producer who was hovering, in the background at the time, who'd said, yes, he would support her. And they'd located a place in Madhya Pradesh where they were going to purpose build the sets and the fort and all that. But soon after, I think it must have been some months after I'd met her, and for a while she was in touch and very excited and all of that, there was that really ghastly TV series called Rani Lakshmibai, I think.
Yes.
And it
yes.
was really, really, really badly done, very wooden and very sort of dull. And, the very accepted version of events and all that, which is quite boring. But anyway, I think the producer, this is the impression I got, but the producer, when that went out and it probably didn't do as well as they'd hoped and all that, and it bombed, the potential producer of her film backed out. So then I don't think she had that kind of money which would have allowed her to you know, do the whole thing, the whole film project. So she never asked for money back. She never kind of, I mean, she probably knew that as per contract, she'd bought the option anyway. And she'd bought it for 10 years. So I was kind of hoping that in that time, she'd find somebody else. I don't know whether the 10 years are up now or not, but I'm not going to be selling it to anyone else anyway. If she popped up suddenly saying, oh, I've now found somebody, I'd be very happy to let her have it for as long as it takes. But yeah, but that was why it didn't happen. And actually, I think she probably won't do it now. I think she felt as if she had a kind of personal mystical connection to Lakshmi Bai. There were many reasons why she felt that, because Lakshmi Bai had adopted, like she had adopted. They had the same birthday, although Lakshmi Bai's birthday is in doubt. There are many people who say the 18th of November, and that is the Sushmita's birthday as well, 18th or something like that of November. So she felt she had lots in common with her, a strong woman and all that. But whether she still carried that on all these years enough to kind of bring up the project again, I don't know, because she wanted to play the part herself then, and now she's probably a little too old for that.
I also read that while you were preparing to write Rani, all you had in mind was a historical fiction about a powerful woman from that era. You were considering a number of women because you thought that writing about Lakshmi Bai would be quite an obvious choice. And although you finally did gravitate back to her, I'm curious to know who else you had in mind while you were doing your research.
Oh, there were some, you know, when I started saying strong women from Indian history, you know, British Indian period, there's an amazing number of women who actually fit the bill. So the one who makes a small appearance in Rani in this book, in Rani Lakshmi Bai's story, but who really is deserving of a book all on her own, and hers was the figure that I really, really struggled with until I finally decided, okay, I'll go with Lakshmi Bai, was Begum Hazrat Mehl, who was the last wife of the Awadh, the Nawab of Awadh, at the same time, so same period. And she was a genuine fighter. She actually sold her jewelry, raised an army, did all the things that Lakshmi Bai didn't do. She actually went out to war and then lost against the British, but didn't die in the battle. She went and took refuge in Nepal, where the king of Nepal gave her refuge. And then she eventually died there, a pauper. So it's quite a sad story, hers. But you know, what it was about Lakshmi Bai that eventually attracted me was that she wasn't a warrior in the way that Hazrat Mehl was. And where I feel sorry for Hazrat Mehl is that that the reputation that was due to her as this freedom fighter and all that, actually, you know, went to Lakshmi Bai in the end. It should have come to Hazrat Mehl. But, you know, who decides these things and who makes heroes from the past, God knows. But Lakshmi Bai's character intrigued me more because she was a pacifist. And that is not what we were taught to believe. So that started to intrigue me more and more. And I found that, like you said, a very modern sensibility to think that, you know, negotiation and diplomacy and legal recourse, and these are all the things to try rather than just jumping on a horse and marching into war.
Yeah.
So that was how I gravitated back to her. But Hazrat Mehl was one. And then there was Ahilya Bai, who was another one who was quite, you know, briefly caught my fancy. There were the Begums of Bhopal, the Sikandar Begum in particular. Mm-hmm. So lots of stories, lots of strong women. So if I had the gumption to take on historical fiction again, I'd be spoiled for choice.
And speaking of historical fiction and how people don't really understand what it is, can we please address the ban in Uttar Pradesh?
Well, it was the kind of thing that you would imagine would happen today is quite easily. But at the time, it was actually a more shocking thing to happen because there was a little bit more freedom of expression around than there is now. But it was, I think it was the love story at the heart of the book that annoyed people, and how they even found out, because most of them hadn't bothered to read the book. But the fact that Lakshmi Bai had a very good relationship with the British political agent in her state, this Major Ellis, and the fact that he actually laid his career on the line to help her is all established fact. You know, there's enough angry letters written by Lord Dalhousie to Major Ellis to establish that. The fact that the thing which we don't know is why, what motivated Major Ellis to take that step. So whether it was just out of a strong sense of justice or whether he admired Rani Lakshmi Bai, bearing in mind that she was a widow by then, running the state all by herself, they must have been working very closely together. So, you know, I'm a novelist. I write love stories. I like love stories. It was irresistible to me to imagine that it was something else that made Major Ellis take all the decisions he did. He was punished by Lord Dalhousie and sent off as far from Jhansi and all that as they could. And there's a very angry letter that I found written by Dalhousie telling Major Ellis to stop helping the Queen. So for a man who worked in the East India Company in that era where it was all very highly controlled and Lord Dalhousie had a reputation for being, you know, a very strict sort of boss involved in every aspect of things, it was a brave sort of thing that poor Major Ellis did. So, yeah, I decided to turn it into a sort of, it's very unspoken, very sort of tremulous sort of love story at the heart of it, which Rani Lakshmibai is just aware of. She doesn't actually go into a love sort of tangle with him. But that was enough to annoy people and upset people. And that quite shocked me. Today, I think I know for a fact that it would annoy and upset a lot of people and I'd be all over social media and probably being trolled to bits. But at that time, it was a bit of a shock that they should take that step. And, you know, there was this bit of shouting on the streets and a small mob had gathered, I think. And the frightening part was that NDTV kept showing what it was, scenes of pandemonium in the assembly, in the UP assembly. But I don't know if they just picked something out of their archive, their libraries and things, or whether it was actually the pandemonium created by my book. But you could see people shouting and then you saw this mob saying Jeshri Murdabad and burning an effigy that. So they put a package together that they kept showing. All day they showed it on their different, you know, news bulletins. And I was sitting in England watching all this on NDTV and getting more and more terrified. So it was, yeah, shocking at the time.
And going back to movie deals, Jayashree, of all the books you've written, including your semi-autobiographical Ancient Promises, which one would you be most excited to see adapted for the silver screen?
Adapted into film?
Yeah.
Probably Rani, the Rani Lakshmibai, because I think it needs to be told, and it can be done beautifully if it's done nicely rather than in this clunky way. But again, a bit incendiary for our times, so I don't make that wish lightly. But apart from that, I think, yeah, I've actually sold film rights to 4 of my books, but none of them, I mean, film projects have stopped exciting me anymore because I think they're just too big, collaborative. Even Ancient Promises has a film producer who bought the rights and he's got the rights right now. A Malayali guy, Sunil Nair.
Oh, wow. I'm so looking forward to watching that film.
But if Ancient Promises specifically gets adapted, who would you want to play your role in the movie?
Oh. Do you know there was interest from Manju Warrier when she heard that there was going to be a Malayalam film? There was an email she wrote to somebody and all that. But then I thought, how are we going to do the younger bits? Because she's also now, she could probably get away with doing the bit where Janu's sort of in her late 20s or whatever it is, the book. But yeah, I would be pushing it really. And you know, you need the same person, but it would look a bit silly to have someone else playing the younger Janu. So,
well, Jayashree, you know, last month we had Anjali Menon on our podcast. And
oh, she's fantastic.
Yeah, so I joked with Ankita that one day Anjali will put us in, me and Ankita in a film. So I'm just putting that out there. If you do need anybody.
Oh, an intro to Anjali Menon would be lovely. And yes, I've seen glimpses of you girls, your photographs. And yeah, if either of you fancies playing Janu, you'd be very welcome.
Oh, fantastic.
I think I should. It's like a divine, because my story is so similar to Janu's, at least the initial bits. And I cannot thank you enough for letting us geek out with you like this. You know, it's been such a pleasure. And I'm once again at a loss to express how happy I'm feeling right now.
No, I've really enjoyed this. And I must say, I'm going to sort of go and look up. I've got the links and things you'd sent me earlier on, because I need to hear some of the other interviews you've done with the more recent ones, Anjali Menon, you mentioned.
Yeah.
So I'll be watching out and listening out, and good luck.
That's amazing. Thank you, Jayashree. In fact, the other day we had Snehal Pradhan, an ex-member of the women's cricket team, on our show, and I'm an athlete myself, so I remember telling Ankita how I could just completely ignore her and just sit in a cafe with Snehal and have an endless discussion about sports, but I kind of know how Ankita feels right now, Jayashree. So thank you once again for coming on the show.
And thank you, dear listeners, for joining in on our conversation with Jayashree. Like I've said 100 times already, this was a dream come true for me, and I'm going to make myself a fake certificate that says Jayashree Mishra called me a good reader.
Jayashree's witty character, her bravery, and most importantly, her kindness really gave me goosebumps today. And thank you, Ankita, for introducing me to such an amazing woman. We hope you enjoyed this conversation just as much as we did. You can find Jayashree on Twitter at Jayashree Mishra. And while you're on social media, do check us out at Desi Outside Outsiders. You can drop in a mail with your thoughts, feedback, or questions to mail@desioutsiders.com. And as always, please rate and review the Desi Outsiders podcast on iTunes and tell all your friends about us.
So until next week, I'm Ankita.
And I'm Meenal.
And we are the Desi Outsiders. Stop there.